Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is September 14th, 2021. My guest is economist and author Arnold Kling. Arnold blogged for many years at EconLog, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty, as is EconTalk. And he currently writes provocative essays at Substack, which I recommend. This is his 17th appearance at EconTalk. He was last here in April of 2020. We took a fresh look at his book, The Three Languages of Politics. We have two topics for today. If we get to them, we'll see. They're both innovative ideas that Arnold has, one for improving government and one for improving our assessment of expertise, Arnold, and public discourse, I would add. Arnold, welcome back to EconTalk.
Thanks, Russ. Great to be here.
We're going to start with this interesting idea you have for making government more effective. In recent years, there's been a lot of talk about what is sometimes called the administrative state, the part of the government that's regulatory and does a lot of administrative stuff that has gotten quite large over the last 50 years and often doesn't work quite as well as we might like. Some people think that's a feature, not a bug. You don't. Well, what can we do to make it better?
Okay, so let me start off by trying to create a contrast between what I'll call naive libertarianism and what Tyler Cowen calls state capacity libertarianism, which sounds a bit like an oxymoron. So basically a naive libertarian, as I term it, is somebody who just wants the state to be as small as possible. Just, you know, protect property, keep the peace, don't do anything else. Keep the state in this small box. And what I'm calling a state capacity libertarian says, look, modern life has many threats and opportunities that seem to call for government, that most people expect government to do something about. And better that government do those well than do it poorly, because if government does those things poorly, it ends up even infringing on liberty even more. That's why how it becomes less of an oxymoron. So let me give two examples of that. One is the pandemic. So I think anyone with any libertarian sensibility at all would say that our government has really abused power and taken a lot of power in dealing with the pandemic, misused power, abused power. I think this week there's a recall election for Governor Newsom, who imposed restrictions on Californians and then himself dined maskless at a fancy restaurant. And that's part of the reason that there's the recall. And there are many examples that that I think all libertarians would agree are sort of outrageous abuses of power, much more significant than just dining maskless at a restaurant. And so the question is, what do you do about that? And again, the naive libertarian might say, well, rip your mask off. Don't be a sissy, take whatever risk you need, dine indoors at a restaurant. The authorities shouldn't be telling you what to do, and we'll end up with herd immunity as the solution to the virus. And a state capacity libertarian says, no, I think most people expect the government to do something about this pandemic, and it should just do things well. The CDC and the FDA shouldn't have screwed up as much as they did. And if they hadn't screwed up, then a lot of these abuses of authority and excess grabbing of power might not have taken place. So that's a contrast in that example. Let me use a less kind of emotionally charged example, the fragility of the power grid. We've seen that recently with a hurricane, and I think people supposedly are going to lose power for several days. Businesses lose power for several days. This far into the 21st century, I think it's wrong to have a power grid that's that fragile. A naive libertarian might say, well, just let the private sector work it out, and it's not an issue for government. But a state capacity libertarian would say, well, wait a minute, if government doesn't ensure that the power grid isn't fragile, we're going to be in situations where the government is going to be stepping in and taking harsh steps. Like, imagine that there was a situation, 10 years from now, where people have to flee a disaster and the power's out, and most of them have electric cars. And so now the government has to say, well, you get to leave and you have to stay in this toxic environment or whatever it is. Or the government has to come in with generators and say, all right, you get to use the generator, or you get the food supplies that we have and you don't. So that I think that if we continue to have a fragile electrical power grid, the government is likely to end up in situations where it's abusing power. So we're better off with an effective government that does something about a fragile power grid. So anyway, those are a couple examples of the contrast. And I guess I've converted over the last year or two from a more naive libertarian point of view to the more state capacity libertarian point of view, that the government ought to do its things well. And I also think that the modern life has created many new threats and opportunities that did not exist 250 years ago when we wrote the Constitution. So the Constitution does not mention the words electrical power grid, amazingly enough, given when it was written.
Go figure.
Yeah. And, it does have the words, promote the general welfare in the preamble, which, of course, can be used as an excuse for almost any government activity. But I think the power grid example is legitimate, and I think there are more and more legitimate uses of government power these days. A few weeks ago, I guess by the time this appears, it'll be longer than a few weeks ago, but you had the podcast on the challenges of property rights nowadays. And I think those have just become much more ambiguous for a variety of reasons. You have people living closer together, so that more of the things I do with my property affect you and your property. I can, block your view. I can put up a noisy establishment next to you, whatever. The more of our assets are intangible, and intangible assets give rise to a lot more ambiguity in terms of property rights. If I'm on a farm, I know what my land is, I know what my farm animals are, I know what my machines are. But when you have something, let's say, as complicated as an iPhone, based on a lot of inventions and ideas, who really owns what? It has to be negotiated a lot. Things like spectrum, the use of the spectrum for communication, that has to be settled somehow. So that the use of ideas, trade names, reputation. There's so much wealth is now intangible, and this intangible property is just not as clearly delineated as to who owns what. So that makes modern life more complicated, and you get a lot more regulation. Financial transactions are way more complicated than they were 250 years ago, and that probably requires a lot more regulation, government involvement. And I think all these trends have, all these sort of threats and opportunities that for government involvement. Like as an opportunity, I could cite maybe like, you know, research into nuclear power or research into longevity, health-related research, whatever. So they've just multiplied over the, you know, last couple hundred years. And life has become very complex, harder to regulate. And so there's just going to be more governance. Now, I think what we're going to see more of is more governance by private sector entities. I mean, the classic ones, the things like underwriters' laboratories setting standards and so on. Or the Internet Engineering Task Forces, that's basically private sector governance. But I think some of it is going to be more additional, more formal governance from government. So I think that that's just the reality that we have to deal with.
So I'm going to let me push back on that a little bit. I know this is not your... You're not defending this, but it is striking that how poorly government has dealt as a regulatory body with innovations of the internet and other things like it. You correctly mentioned that intangible property does lead to some new questions, I would say. You know, whether how big government has to be to deal with those is a different question. Whether the courts could deal with them or not is a different question. But certainly the regulatory response to Uber, Lyft, et cetera, Airbnb, it struggled to respond to that in a thoughtful way. Not surprisingly, no one would say the government is nimble or innovative in that kind of response. It's slow. It might get better. The other thing I think that I'm concerned about is thinking about why the administrative state has grown as much as it has. We could debate with how big it should be, you know, how much room should be left for private sector governance. But there's a lot of public sector governance now. And the question is why? And you talk about that in your essay on this that we will link to if you've published it yet. I don't remember if you have. But if we think about why the administrative state is so large, the right word really is intrusive. It's not so much the magnitude of it as it is meaning – you can measure magnitude in dollars, you can measure it in employees, but just the scope for intervention, you know, everything from soft drinks to standards that you've alluded to, but sometimes are not necessarily productive standards or exclusionary to keep out competitors. It's a form of rent seeking and so on. But I think the overall growth of it is a fascinating and somewhat alarming response of Congress to the kind of economic changes you're talking about. Congress is supposed to be the regulatory arm, I think, of the federal government. It's not the Supreme Court. It's not the executive branch. And what they really appear to like to do, and I can't remember who has written about this, you probably will, what they really like to do is to write a kind of vague law, legislation, excuse me, write fairly vague legislation that the courts interpret and that eventually builds out the actual legislation, the actual regulation. And Congress likes not being in charge of that because they don't have to take any of the blame for how it actually turns out in practice. And if it turns out decently, or at least they can wave around the fact that they, quote, did something about it. And I think the lack of accountability of the current administrative state is deeply alarming. And I think I should – this is maybe a good segue. You can say some other preface-like things if you'd like. But certainly the current administrative state does not have the kind of accountability and incentives for performance that we'd want to have given its size, right? Yeah. If it was a small little backwater, if we'd say, well, you know, I wish the Department of Motor Vehicles ran a little better. It actually does, by the way. You know, libertarians and others like to complain about the Department of Motor Vehicles. In America, it's quite a bit improved over my lifetime. I think partly because service has improved in other parts of the economy. And so even the government has some embarrassment. Those agencies feel like they have to at least keep up in some dimension. But if that were the main problem is that, you know, I wish the Department of Motor Vehicles was a little quicker. Well, that would be one thing. But that's not what we're talking about here. So you might want to respond to that by talking about some of the range of things the administrative state has gotten tangled in, why you think it needs an overhaul.
Okay, so I mean, I think all those criticisms are valid. I think a lot of people say that, you know, it would be a good idea to have Congress take on more responsibility, not delegate as much to these agencies. But be careful what you wish for, because congressmen are really, really deeply ignorant about these issues, including technology. And that would actually be very dangerous. So I think we need to address two things. We need to make an administrative state that's effective, and we need to make an administrative state that's accountable. So you've raised both of those issues. And effective includes not stepping into areas where it doesn't need to step into. And that's an important part of it. So, you know, you can think of a bunch of potential errors, almost like type 1, type 2 errors. So you could have the administrative state not do enough in areas. And I would say, you know, keeping the electrical grid robust is an area where it's, you know, doing too little. You can see areas where it's doing too much. I mean, I think the TSA, the airport screening process is just out of control. I mean, the costs, including the cost to the users, are huge relative to what I think the benefits are. So there's doing too little, doing too much, and then doing things badly. And then all along there's this lack of accountability, which means that with some exceptions like the Department of Motor Vehicles, bad policies and bad regulations can persist, and incompetence can persist, and so on.
Can I take an example for Zach Arnold? You mentioned it. You alluded to it in your opening. You know, the CDC did a particularly bad job encouraging testing in the early days of the pandemic, and the FDA.
I would say they've never done it right.
Okay. So they did a bad job. It's fascinating to me. I didn't think about it until we have this conversation. Who made those decisions at the FDA site? You could say, well, it doesn't matter. The head of the FDA is responsible. That's very possible. You could argue that person should be responsible for that decision. But it's interesting to me that while a lot of economists complained about, particularly Paul Romer on this program very early on in the pandemic, that there were rapid tests available, that this would help in contact and tracing, and it would be great with contact tracing, and that would be great. I don't know a name. Now, right. I don't even know who was the head of the FDA in that time, which is fascinating by itself. Yeah. But no one at the FDA stood up and said, well, I did that, and here's why I did it. Maybe I was wrong, but no one said at the time, so-and-so pulled the sign that made that decision that discouraged, that said you had to use the FDA handful that had been approved or whatever it was. Isn't it interesting that that's not like there's no shame or blame? Forget the fact that nobody got fired, as far as I know. Yeah. No one even got embarrassed by it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a major characteristic of bureaucracy. One of its functions, it's certainly not it. Maybe it's even intended, but often unintended, is to diffuse blame to the point where you don't have anyone you can blame. And so, businesses discovered, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, that you wanted to have people accountable. You wanted the CEO to be able to point a finger and say who was responsible for something, because CEOs were actually encountering their own bureaucracy and not being able to figure out who had made a decision and so on. So one of the ideas that I have are they're kind of twin ideas for improving the administrative state. One is to actually have the administrative state organized like a business organization, you know, not profit seeking. Obviously, there are things you can't have, but actually to have a chief operating officer who can reorganize, fire, hire, put in systems of accountability, do the things that businesses do to make their organizations function. Get rid of overlapping responsibilities as much as possible, or manage those overlapping responsibilities. Install a culture into the organization that where people are trying to be effective and people are being held accountable. So it's a very ambitious idea, and I also we should also be wary of having a chief operating officer become a permanent, or semi-permanent, almost autocrat. I mean, a J. Edgar Hoover or an Alan Greenspan, who's got so much, individual power that they, kind of overpower everyone else in government. I think that would be, that's, we can talk about plenty of downsides of this COO model. So that's one thing. And the other key element, structurally, is I think we need a very powerful audit agency, an agency that can step in and evaluate how the regulatory agencies are doing, make sure that they're not abusing power, and question them when they're not being effective. Things like, the government is notoriously poor at using technology. The Obamacare website rollout, illustrated that. They're trying to, hook together system, old mainframe systems, and create something that would immediately serve the public in real time. And it was just, it was a mess and a disaster. It was poorly organized and so on. An audit agency would maybe be able to identify ways in which, technology needs to be upgraded or systems need to be upgraded. Maybe the biggest example, or the most compelling example of the use of an audit agency, is on the issue of surveillance. So, as I've said, threats and opportunities have multiplied, and threats include, bioterrorism, cyber attacks, what have you. I think it's inevitable we're going to have a lot of surveillance by government agencies. It's they're going to be constantly pushing whatever boundary you set. You want them to be subject to checks and balances. You don't want to have them, just wait for, your Edward Snowdens or types to expose them. I would want to have an audit agency able to look in on the National Security Agency or the FBI or whatever and say, okay, clearly they're abusing their power here. They shouldn't be doing this. Maybe here's ways they could use surveillance better or whatever. But I want somebody with authority and technical skill and resources looking in on these surveillance agencies and making sure they behave. And I think that holds for all of these regulatory agencies. The Federal Reserve is notoriously resistant to any sort of auditing, and I think that's wrong.
So. Well, your idea, sort of a, what do you call it, sort of a good idea, if I might. I mean, it's not a bad idea if it worked. My skepticism is mainly my unease as to whether it would actually work. But it reminds me a lot of the role that we used to think journalism played in our democracy. So journalism, great journalists, investigative journalists, look for money that's being wasted, look for corruption, look for overlapping responsibilities, and so on. Would it be possible to fulfill some of the role that you suggest an independent or a new regulatory oversight body would perform if instead we allowed – not allowed, we made government less opaque, forced some kind of transparency on agencies, and let journalists and others who were interested in it expose those inadequacies?
A couple of reactions to that. First of all, journalists are way under-resourced relative to what I think is needed. I mean, the amount of expertise that's needed to second guess the Fed on bank regulatory matters, or to And so deal with things like that. Also, for something like surveillance, it's not that you want to give that to, you know, to journalists to put on the front page.
Yeah, not the surveillance. That would be an exception. But I'm thinking about the other things. And by the way, the Shadow Fed, which in the old days was Carl Bruner and Alan Meltzer and their friends, kind of did exactly what we're talking about. They audited the Fed and used what public data and information they had to critique it, and had the expertise to do so.
They most focused on monetary policy. There was also something called a Shadow Regulatory Committee, and that group should have been listened to. Actually, had they been listened to, I believe we would not have had the financial crisis that we had. I mean, it's a whole digression to go into, but I'll just put it out there, and I actually put it out there in writing somewhere. I can't remember where. But they had things right on how to regulate risk taking by financial institutions, but they got nowhere. And that's so there's just this lack of institutional power, and that I would say that would be the same thing with journalists. A big challenge with the approach I'm suggesting, which is this powerful chief operating officer and this also powerful audit agency, is maintaining the balance of power. You don't want the audit agency to be so powerful that the regulatory agencies forget who their real customers are and just focus on passing the audits. And you don't want the regulatory agencies to be so powerful that they can blow off everybody, so that, you know, you say they want them to be transparent, but then they hold off and, you know, have secret meetings where they make the real decisions and so on. So maintaining that balance of power is critical in this approach. And stepping back a bit, I'd say that a disadvantage of the government process relative to the market process is the market process has these natural checks. That's competition. So if a business does something ineffectively or does something wrong, a competitor will come in and do it better. And so it forces some positive evolution. And what I'm trying to do is create some of that tension between the regulatory agencies and a powerful audit agency, so that you don't just have this static regulatory agency without any checks at all.
But as we know, and this FDA CDC example is kind of a perfect example, where journalists were very good at informing us what was going on, I think, or at least pretty good. I think the public had a pretty good idea what went wrong at the CDC and what went wrong at the FDA. Maybe they made a different type of error in response to those mistakes. But and similarly, I would point out that the World Health Organization, which is a not unimportant body, was, it seems to me, overly responsive to China in the aftermath of the pandemic. And a lot of journalists correctly pointed that out. The challenge, I think, is that having pointed that out, there weren't a lot of consequences, as we've been talking about. So the hard part of your proposal, it would seem to me, would be fleshing out what exactly that COO would be able to do. So, we had one of my all-time favorite episodes of Econ Talk is it was actually a debate. There were very few on this program, but Robert Frank and I had talked about infrastructure, and as part of an NPR interview that they ended up using like 10 minutes of, and we argued about it for about an hour, and it was deliberately combative in a respectful way, and Bob Frank and I both respect each other, so it was really fun. I love that conversation. We'll put a link up to it. But the disagreement there fundamentally was that Bob basically wanted I'd point out, he'd say, we need better infrastructure. And I'd say, sure we do. You're right. We already spend a lot on it. And he said, yeah, so we need to spend it better. And how would we do that? We'd have a committee of people who'd decide. Well, that's a lovely idea. We have a committee now. It's called Congress. They don't do a good job. The incentives aren't there for them to do a good job. And so it's all well and good. I'm picking on Bob here now, but respectfully, I hope. And I'm making the same challenge to you, which is all well and good to say, yeah, we need better oversight or we need better auditing. Why would they do a good job? What would be this incentive structure and power that they would have that would be different than what the current structure has, which is not very good. You know, again, I'm not an anarchist. I'm not saying we should have no regulation or no government because it's poorly run. But, you know, there are a lot of things government does, I think, that are poorly done that it's okay that they do it, you know, like pollution control, and they do it badly. They respond to political incentives. But it's probably a better world with that bad politicized pollution control than having none at all, probably. But so how would we get there from here? What's your idea for what this all-wise COO, right? It's a great idea, by the way, that, you know, the president, for example, is really bad at running the executive branch. Can't.
Yeah,
too much.
I mean, and no experience. I mean, Obama had never supervised an organization larger than, you know, a Senate staff. And he had no idea what he was getting into. And very few have. I think the last president with real broad administrative experience we had was Dwight Eisenhower, who I think is underrated and pretty good compared to what followed.
He was a president in the 50s, for those listening in the United States.
Yeah. We have very
As we date ourselves, yeah.
Right. Well, I have no memory of him, actually, of watching him on TV.
Neither do I.
Right.
I was four. I think I was, excuse me, I was six when he left office.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but yeah, that, but yeah, I think you need that level of administrative experience to really, you know, run the government. And of course, the president has other jobs as well, besides just sort of running the agencies. And he has very little control over the agencies. The agencies are, you know, created as independent. And there, I think I once calculated there, in the org chart, there's something like 150 direct reports to the president. And no corporation has 150 direct reports to the CEO. So, yeah, there's just lots of room for somebody, somebody who comes from the business world, a COO of a large corporation, to organize things and make people accountable. And, you know, there's definitely room for improvement, as you know. And then the question of how to get there. The issue of how to get there would be, you know, I mean,
and we should add,
a few steps at a time.
We should clarify, a COO is a chief operating officer often of a large corporation.
Right.
Responsible for day-to-day execution of the goals of the organization. Having such a person in government seems like a very good idea. The question would be, what would constrain that person?
I think a few things. First of all, the president and Congress in that model become sort of like chairman of the board and board of directors, respectively. So they're responsible ultimately for receiving the reports from the audit agency and for firing the CEO if there's doing a bad job, and just generally overseeing their activities and examining sort of the most important activities pretty regularly, and just saying here's this, things are going well, if there are things that are not going well. They would have that kind of high-level oversight responsibility, and then the audit agency would hopefully be a very powerful check. If an audit report comes back and says, you know, this agency, let's call it the Federal Communications Commission, you know, is really falling down on the job, and here's point one, point two, point three, then presumably the president and the Congress would step in, if the COO doesn't want to do something about it, the president and the Congress would step in and say, okay, something has to be done about this, or the COO is going to get fired, or there's going to be some consequences if these audit issues aren't addressed.
Let me try a radical softening of your proposal. I might be more attracted to it, if I could. Yeah. What if we had, if the only thing the COO ran was the audit agency? So the audit agency has a lot of power. It has a lot of ability to discover what's going on. It can force open the books and so on. Now, of course, there are such agencies now in the government. They mainly audit private sector activity. And
there's things
sometimes,
like GAO.
Well, there is the General Accounting Office, Government Accounting Office, the GAO. Yeah. But it's I challenge our listeners. I wonder if there is, you know, there'd be about something like over 100,000 people are going to at least download this episode, Arnold. They may not all listen to it. I'm sorry to report. But of that 100,000, how many of them have consumed a GAO report? It might be 100. It's not more than 100, I don't think. It might be as few as 10. So the GAO does not have a lot of, I would say, traction in encouraging effectiveness. I'm not saying they're ineffective. They may be a really important agency. It's interesting how little I know about them. But they don't get a lot of attention. But what if we took – we created a new one that was explicitly designed to audit regulatory agencies. It was under the leadership of a COO or an audit president, whatever we call the person.
Yeah, call him an audit president just to avoid confusion.
Yeah, we'll call it the president of the auditing organization. And all that did, all this agency does is audit the agency that it's responsible for. It might be one for each agency, actually.
Right.
And we publicize the heck out of the annual findings. And that's all we do. They have no power. They can't fire people. They can't change policy. They can't reduce budget. They can't do anything. All they can do is wave it around. And is it imaginable that a government agency like the FDA or the CDC or the FCC or the Fed would ever quake in fear of why did I say quail? I think I meant quake. Quake in fear of that annual report that could highlight, let's just start with embarrassing things. Is there any way we could use public shame as a way to encourage performance? I mean, there are a lot of places that are scared of being observed, right? A lot of agencies, a lot of organizations don't want to be publicly. Now, if it could work the opposite way, of course, it could be so frightening and so discouraging that they would be more cautious than we'd want them to be. But anyway, does that have any appeal to you?
Yeah, I mean that gets to this whole balance of power issue. Would in the absence of a chief operating officer, would a powerful audit agency be effective? And I think it would have too little power because of the problem that you highlighted with the CDC and the FDA. There's no one to take responsibility for the decision. You know, the bureaucracy just has so many, you know, it can just absorb criticism without doing anything. And the goal with a COO would get somebody with business who's experienced in business and can't live with that. You know, a COO can't be defeated by his own bureaucracy. I mean, if something really important is wrong, he has to be able to fix it. He or she has to be able to fix it. And you know, so that's why I think that's an important part of the proposal.
But I mean, think about this. You know, a lot of economists, especially market-oriented economists, like to blame the FDA. You know, it goes back to Sam Peltzman's paper that suggested the FDA's caution in approving drugs has cost so many lives because it's raised the cost of compliance to such a point that it discourages innovation and so on. And then what economists then say is, yeah, because the committee that votes on such a drug, if something bad happens – they'll get blamed, and if something good happens, they aren't going to get much of the credit. But I'm not sure they get blamed. Like, we're talking about a case right now where they don't get blamed.
Yeah.
We don't know who they are. Yeah. What difference does it make? So I find it – I don't think it's a secret that there's no one to point the finger at. It's just – I'm not quite sure what the reason is. It fascinates me, actually.
Yeah. Well, it is an interesting question, but I think it probably goes to – you know, the incentives and organization of government, and you know, sort of the goal of the chief operating officer idea is to sort of shake that up and maybe change that. You know, there's just countless examples of somebody comes in, a political appointee, and can't get the bureaucracy to change. And maybe the same thing would happen to the chief operating officer. Just for all his effort and so-called power and publicity, might end up, you know, being absorbed by the blob. I mean, it could happen. But I think that's a tough challenge.
Well, before we leave this topic, I want to ask you about government bureaucracy generally. There are a handful of places that I know of, and there might be more, where the bureaucrats that we're talking about have a positive reputation. They're respected. They're thought well of. And I think that's quite rare in the United States, but it's not rare, at least in my vague understanding, in places like France. Historically, China has been known for its well-educated and high-level bureaucracy. I think of Whitehall in England, the Foreign Service.
Singapore.
I don't know if those are true, but what I think is true is that there are cultures in foreign countries that respect the people who have the task of enforcing the laws and the regulations. And we didn't get to talk about it yet, but in your essay you talk a lot about we need to improve the culture of the bureaucracy or the humility of the regulators. It's a very tough thing to do. I'd say close to impossible, but I'll give you a chance to defend it in a second. But my point is that in America, the bureaucratic infrastructure is not well respected, and presumably that does not thereby attract the most talented people. We could argue that's a good thing. We could say
I'd push back on that. I mean,
go ahead.
I think people,
says the man who used to work at the Fed. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the Fed is, you know, I mean, there's a lot of deference to the Fed. I mean, you know, people want to throw more responsibilities at the Fed. During the debate over healthcare, former Senator Tom Daschle said we need something like the Fed to oversee healthcare. The Fed is the classic example. The CDC was an example. And so, even some people to this day say, listen to the CDC, they're the experts. And even though a lot of us have lost respect for that. There may be, you know, in America, this kind of, you know, residual populist, you know, anti-elite, anti-expert point of view. I that's definitely there. But I think the real problem, or a real problem, is among the so-called experts themselves. That could almost lead into our second topic.
Yeah, let's do that. We have 20 minutes or so. This is a really – so, Arnold, your first idea, I'm going to give a B to, maybe a B minus. If I were a harsher grader, when I was younger, I'd have given at least at best a C plus. It's interesting. It identifies a serious problem. I'm not convinced by the solution. I know you're not convinced of it either, but it's a provocative idea. Your next idea is even crazier. So go ahead.
Okay, so those of you who are familiar with fantasy sports, the idea is you pick a team of players. I'll do baseball, even though most people do football, but you pick a team of players and their statistics are aggregated and you compete with other fantasy owners, and the ones with the best statistics wins.
There's a set of rules about how the statistics are aggregated, because it's not just batting average. It's going to be a whole bunch of things, and those are all adding different points to your team's score.
So what I created for a couple months, it proved to be a little bit too much work for me, but something called fantasy intellectual teams, and where first of all, you have to come up with statistical categories for intellectuals. The idea was that if on your team, you know, you've picked your fantasy intellectuals, the people you want to follow. So you could follow Russ Roberts, you could follow Tyler Cowen, you could follow whoever. And you take their writings and their podcasts, and you try to and we count points. Well, the crucial thing is, how are these points counted? And so I think I had eight categories.
I think number of podcast episodes lifetime would be an important score.
But Russ actually scored a lot of points for asking devil's advocate questions. So that was one of the scoring categories. It's like provoking the guest into answering a tough question. Another thing was thinking in bets. So actually, stating the odds of your position. Another category was caveats, admitting that there could be a problem with one of your proposals. Another one was showing an open mind, saying, I would change my mind if, like recently, Larry Summers said, I would change my mind about, these deficits being inflationary if such and such happened. That was a very clear open mind point that he would have scored. Looking at research, not just, this supports my point of view, but really evaluating the quality of the research. So Scott Alexander and Emily Oster are great examples of people who do that. And Russ is holding up his hand saying, I do that.
No, I wasn't. No, I was going to say Scott Alexander wins that category beyond. I mean, no one is writing today, as in my view, as objectively and fairly as he does in assessing our state of knowledge about a question based on the research that's out there. He looks at it incredibly thoroughly. He's open-minded, appears to be open-minded about it. He critiques his own side. He scores points relentlessly in the Kling fantasy intellectual team. He's a superstar.
Yeah.
I like Emily too. She's coming to Econ Talk soon to talk about her new book. So no problem. Okay. There.
Yeah. The basic goal of this project was to take sort of the status producing things away from Twitter likes and Facebook shares, and give it to these points, so that if the public were paying attention to these points, they would be looking at more rational discourse, less tribal discourse, and the result would be to raise the status of the Scott Alexanders and Emily Osters, and lower the status of the sort of partisan hacks.
Yeah, you don't have to name them. Go ahead. So it's a brilliant idea. Of course, as you point out, the implementation depends on how you keep score and the methods that you mentioned. The only problem there is that showing up in somebody's blog that has 43 readers and saying I might be wrong is different than saying that in the New York Times. So you could wait for that, correct it by waiting the venue and all that. And somebody has to keep track of public pronouncements of those folks.
Yeah, and another issue, and this is something raised by a couple of, not that they looked at this topic, but just generically by a couple of fantasy intellectuals, namely Daniel Kahneman and Cass Sunstein, is the problem of noise. It's a judgment call, whether this person really gave a caveat or didn't, or whether this person steel-manned the opponent, the other point of view or didn't. So there were a lot of judgment calls, and there are a lot of And when there's judgment, there's going to be what they call noise. Like, just on a different day, I might score a point or not score a point. Or two different judges might score points differently. So there's a lot of work to be done to kind of lower the noise level in your judgments to a reasonable amount. And then a ton of work to be done in kind of getting hiring lots and lots of judges to judge these things, or better yet, developing artificial intelligence, machine learning to learn how to do it. So I think with enough institutional resources behind it, you could make something like this work. But I haven't lobbied for that.
But the part about that's fantastic that I love is that, as you point out implicitly in your earlier remark, right now, the thrill you get as a public intellectual from a nasty slam of a alternative viewpoint, which gains you a lot of extra followers on Twitter or Facebook likes, is the currency of public intellectual life right now, up to a point. I mean, some people get paid for what they do, and how much you get paid, though, is often related to what you're talking, to the negative side of how much of a hack you are, how partisan you are, how ideological, how arrogant, how ranty you are, and versus calm and thoughtful. But what you're suggesting is that, you know, if you finished on the All-Star team and you thereby rewarded the people who had been visionary in drafting you, it might change how you spoke and how you talked. And people, we could have, of course, I don't remember if you did this, but you could have a negative team, you know, you could have, it's like golf. You want to have, yeah. You have a high score for obnoxious people and a low score for humble people. And the high scorers would have to, you know, again, be kind of embarrassed, and they might change what they say and do. You could take the top 100 economists on Twitter, the ones with just purely based on the most followers, and do this based on their tweets and rank them. The problem with that, of course, is that who cares what I or you or I think about that? But if the New York Times published it, or the Wall Street Journal, or it got some footing and people started to pay attention to it, you could affect discourse. So it's a brilliant idea. What happened to it?
I'd say a couple of things. Mostly, it was consuming my life for the 2 months I did it, just doing the grading of these things. And that was with only a few owners. You know, so my dream was, you know, not to get it publicized sort of top down from the New York Times, but sort of bottom up by lots of people joining leagues and drafting teams and so on. But if that had actually happened, I mean, I would have just been a basket case, you know, keeping track of all these people.
How many people played?
I forget. Roughly. I had roughly 10 or so.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was thinking. So I say 7. 10's small.
Yeah. And, you know, they each pick, you know, like 5 people to follow, and that's a lot of people. The other thing, and you'll appreciate this, is that a lot of the highest points scored were not in individual essays, but in podcasts. I mean, I listened to more podcasts when I was doing this than just like the rest of my life put together, because it turns out I was forced to think about this because it surprised me that how strong the podcasts were. It turns out that having another person in the room makes you be more civilized.
Yeah, for sure.
So. Just an awful lot of the points were scored in podcasts. Robert Wright was great. Coleman Hughes, I mean, Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter. Andrew Sullivan did better in his podcast than in his essays and so on.
But it just adds another category, right? The gap between your podcast and your – I mean, it would be better to have the gap between your, say, essays and – some say high-end newspaper versus say how you acted at your dinner table, but we don't usually have access to that. And I've noticed that many times, by the way, on this program. One of the things that frustrates me a great deal, and I'm not good at dealing with it, is the guest who writes a really nasty book. But when I interview them, they're you know, sweet and kind, and somehow they don't have those criticisms they did in the book. And there are a lot of possible reasons for that. But again, no one holds them. I should hold them accountable, and I'm not so good at it. But if we had a way to hold them accountable, that they were inconsistent, it's really, that would be a cool thing.
Yeah, I agree. I wish we had more content generated in podcasts. But all those podcasts have transcripts because it's so much, it's sure. So time consuming to listen to them. That's the downside of them.
So one response to this would be, well, you did it for 2 months, it's a pain in the neck, so you stopped. But of course, it's an ongoing thing. There isn't a literal fantasy intellectual team, but just by laying out the principles of what you think would make a good expert, that is thoughtful, respectful of the other side, willing to admit that they're wrong, and so on. These are things we can all take with us and can all use to evaluate. Maybe not attribute a particular exact score as to who's better than someone else. But, you know, I just raved about Scott. Scott Alexander is a phenomenal – I hate the term public intellectual, but that's what he is. We call him a commentator if you want or something else. But he's an academic who's not at a college. just like you are, yeah. right? You are. That's a real public intellectual, actually, is a better way to say it. And they're incredibly valuable, people who are able to do those things. It's interesting that it's not necessarily where most people find their sweet spot. They tend to be more drawn to the alternative system that you were critiquing earlier. And it's just interesting to think about ways that we might enhance that.
Just to the what I would call go along to get along system. Like there was just Tyler just this morning linked to a guy's Twitter feed on sort of how to be a successful academic economist, and it says, well, when you're running your PhD thesis, don't work on any major questions because that's too risky. You know, just do something, you know, straightforward. And it's like,
slice the salami. Take another slice off the salami.
Yeah. And it's just there's just a lot of that going on, and you know, people just keep trying to keep their, you know, duck their heads, and you know, they're obviously not public intellectuals, but that, I think that's kind of the more typical academic. I think you know, a lot of about half of my Substack essays are I call them, you know, catching up with the fits of intellectual teams, and I just sort of take mostly people who were highlighted as fantasy intellectuals and point to things where they kind of exemplify their reasoned discourse so that people can, you know, if people were to read the links on those things, they would see, you know, what good reasoned discourse looks like. And so that, you know, would keep it top of mind.
So, what's going to happen to this? And the answer is nothing in the short run because you're too busy and it just was too much work. But I think it's a fruitful question.
Also, I think it's ahead of its time or weird of its time. It's sort of an oxymoron. You know, something like, you know, how many people are interested in fantasy football and following intellectual discourse? I mean, it's an interesting intersection.
Do you play fantasy football, by the way?
No, of course not. I'm way too snobby for that. I only play fantasy baseball.
Do you play fantasy baseball?
Yes, I do. My team has emerged into first place. Amazing luck. I have the Toronto Blue Jays offense. The people forced me to take it, and I took it, and there you have it.
Good year for you. But I think it's worth thinking about. I mean, I think it's an incredibly fun idea, and I think rewarding quality expertise with honor, which is what your effort was about, is a lovely idea. But I think it's worth thinking about what else might encourage that kind of improved performance on the part of experts, right? It would be really fun for somebody in authority, either intellectual authority or actual authority, to say, you know, I really messed that one up. Yeah. Don't hear that very often. You score a lot of points. That one might be you might just, you know, overweight that in the, actually, I think, or maybe you should write a book, with this idea where you could highlight, you know, the all-stars and the people who should be relegated to the second tier. If I could use a European football analogy.
Possibly. That's an interesting thought. Somehow I think the process by which people have, you know, get to the top in terms of status has really fallen apart. It's particularly noticeable in academia and journalism. You know, I just don't think maybe some of the best journalists end up at the New York Times and Washington Post, but it seems like a lot of the worst ones do. And there's, you know, there's not great quality control.
Based on what criteria are you making that bold claim?
I'd say
reliability, honesty.
First of all, you know, nonpartisanship is an important one. Shoe leather effort rather than sort of opining from their desk, sort of the real investigative reports. I mean, look, I mean, you've had some on yours, like Sam Canones. There's still some real shoe leather journalism being done, but it shows up in odd corners like that rather than, in mainstream, in the leading outlets. And the claim is that it's too expensive to do real shoe leather reporting.
By shoe leather reporting, I mean people going out and actually digging around, trying to find what's going on, interviewing lots of people, traveling, and so on.
Going back to what you said about the earlier thing, why can't journalists be the ones who audit regulatory agencies? And just the amount, first of all, the amount of expertise required, and then the time and effort, and then no monetary reward for it. I mean, if you expose what's, the mistakes made by the Federal Communications Commission, how many clicks is that going to get?
Yeah, well, that's a different problem. I'll mention that I think it'll be out by the time this comes out. Sam Quinones has a new book out called The Least of Us that will be coming out, a conversation about that. But I think the idea of ProPublica was this idea that, bankrolled by a large philanthropic effort, journalists would have the freedom and the resources to dig deeply into various issues. I think they've done some, quite a bit, actually. I don't read them carefully, but every once in a while something comes across my screen from them that's thoughtful and interesting. And, maybe that was a long time ago. I don't know if they've maintained that quality. But it's a lovely idea. And it's not the greatest idea that, unfortunately, in today's world, as you point out, not everybody wants to pay for it. So it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add? We're almost done, but anything else you want to add about expertise and the current state? As you point out, I think one of the most depressing things about the current world is how hard it is to figure out who's actually a reliable expert. I think there are still some out there, but who you can trust, and it's gotten harder despite the fact that we live in a world with more information. That paradox is something we've talked about on the program, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think the focus ought to be on the selection process. And of course, the Fantasy Intellectual Teams is a kind of attempt to revise the selection process, at least for some types of people. And somehow, I think you've talked about this before many times, the selection process selects against humility. I mean, people want you to sound confident and assured. Sure. And, someone like me who might say, well, on the one hand, on the other, here's a caveat. That's not who is select for it. And whose fault is that? In some sense, maybe we've met the enemy and he is us. I mean, yeah. Selecting for the Scott Alexander, in a fair world, we would select for the Scott Alexanders of the world, and not the people who sound so self-assured and seek a lot of personal power and glory.
My guest today has been Arnold Kling. Arnold, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thanks.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.